And welcome back to Coast, Randall Bell with us, Dr. Randall Bell, PhD, Rich Habits, Rich Life, and we're going to take your phone calls this hour as we talk about how to handle disasters and personal tragedies. And if you want to share one of those stories with us, please join us. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Randall Bell with us. Randall, so I think it's important, too, to create that island, to take care of the people you care about, the ones you love, because that's probably the best we can do. But are we sticking our heads in the sand, avoiding what's really on the outside?
Well, I don't think so. I think that we have to be aware of what's going on the outside. But I've discovered through, having been to and researched more disasters around the world, I think, than anybody in history, that people really live their lives with two great lies. The first great lie is that it can't happen to me, and which is directly on point with your point, George, that you have to be aware of what's going on around you, because if you're not and you do stick your head in the sand, you're gonna end up in a disastrous situation. The second great lie is, once disaster strikes, is that there's no hope. And of course there's hope. There's always ways to move forward. I volunteer with the homeless shelter here in Laguna Beach where I live, and I see people get back on their feet all the time. So those are the two great lies, and I think we have to stay informed or we're going to be sucked into a disaster if we're in delusional thinking that it can't happen to me.
Well, that's absolutely true. So when you go through these episodes and when people bring you in, what are they primarily looking for from you? What do they want?
Well, they're in the recovery phase. You know, there's a cycle. I call it the prosperity cycle. You're in prosperity, and a lot of times that leads to arrogance, and arrogance leads to disaster. And I get called in because they want my specialty, despite my nicknames, and as Captain Bizarre, you'll appreciate this. I'm not really into disaster. I'm into recovery. That's really my specialty. And trying to get things back on their feet, and to do that, there has to be an honest assessment of what went wrong, what happened, how do we rebuild, and that's my specialty.
Will the parents of the people who were killed in any episode, whether it's a mall, a theater shooting, what happened out in Paris, will those people, the next of kin, will they ever recover from this?
You don't get over those situations. In my own family, I have two nieces that have tragically passed away, so those issues hit, you know, particularly home for me personally. You never get over that. They'll never get over it. My family will never get over it. What you do is you get through it. And the way you do, there are steps you can take to get through it successfully and to put your energy into positive things despite the grief. That's how we get through it.
I've lost over the last 4 years, Randall, my father back in 2011 and my sister last year. She tragically of a brain tumor, and my father of, 88 years old. He was 88 years old. Two different feelings. I miss them both. I wish they'd still be with us. But in my dad's case, he lived a great life, and he was 88 years old, and right. I would be lucky to live that long. And so it's a different kind of missing with him. My sister, on the other hand, 56 years old, life shortened, sadly died tragically, and her family was at her bedside with her two wonderful daughters and her wonderful husband, my brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. That one hurts because that was too soon.
Yeah.
So how do you adapt to two different tragedies, one that you can accept more than the other?
Yeah. Well, that is hitting the nail on the head with the great question. And I'm sorry for your losses in both cases. I can relate. The thing to do is to take to first of all, when you're sad, let yourself be sad. I think people that are sad or upset, try and move through it too superficially, too quickly, and it really damages the psychology. I think when we're sad, we just have to be sad and allow that phase to go through that phase successfully, and then really think of ways to channel that grief in a successful way. I was working on the nuclear weapons test sites on the Bikini Atoll. I worked on that case for 7 years where islanders were literally bombed by the U.S. government, and I had a client there in the Marshall Islands. He lost his daughter to leukemia because his 8-year-old daughter who died in a Bethesda, Maryland hospital. So a lot of grief there. While I was there, I ran into a doctor here stuck on these islands for days or weeks on end, and he had lost a patient who had been bitten by a poisonous snake, and he didn't know that the medical book he read said give a vial of anti-venom and you know, things get better. What he didn't understand, you had to keep giving that anti-venom serum every hour. The book didn't explain that. And he was really, really tied up in emotion about losing this patient. And had he known, he would have saved this guy's life. And it was really sad. We were sitting there on this island, no electricity, nothing to do but talk to the other scientists on the island. And we had a long talk about the grief he was going through as a doctor, and the resolution we came to is right on point with your question. He was going to go back to Malaysia, where he was from, and he was going to contact that publisher of that book, set him straight, and he was going to give seminars and make sure all that he was going to broadcast far and wide so that other people didn't lose their life. That's post-traumatic thriving. That's doing something positive, even though you've been through something really difficult. And we got to all find that special way to move forward successfully in spite of those tragedies.
Randall, tell me about your work on the Heaven's Gate mass suicide case.
Well, George,
Oh
it
my
was bizarre.
God. Yeah.
You know, the guy that owned that house called me literally while the county was still and the sheriff were going through things, and he asked me to come down and help him out. He was really concerned about saving his real estate and his portfolio. And I said, "Well, are there bodies still in the house?" And he said, "Yeah, they're clearing them out." And I said, "Well, wait till they're out, because I don't honestly want to see that. Let me know." So the day after they finished clearing out the bodies, I came down, and I got to tell you, George, that house smelled so bad.
Oh my God.
I can't even describe it. For some reason, I was wearing a suit, and when I got home that day, I went and jumped in the pool with my suit on it. I didn't want to go into the house smelling like that. It was so bad. And it was bizarre. I don't belong to cults. I have limited, understanding of cults. But I was in that house week in and week out studying how cults operate. And what's so funny is I can't get two friends to come over and help me move a refrigerator. How this guy Doe convinced 38 other people to get, the males get castrated and to eat this pudding and purple shrouds and commit mass suicide. That's persuasion.
Well, how do you find 72, how do you find, 8 people who want 72 virgins to do what they're going to do,
Exactly. And it's brainwashing and it's mind control. And it really, that case gave me a real good insight into how these maniacs operate, and they take away the ability to think for yourself. That house was labeled. Everything was labeled. The kitchen sink, every light switch, every jar, every closet, everything meticulously, obsessively was labeled. And I didn't know what that was all about. And then a reporter, I was going through the house with a reporter, and she said, "You know what? He wants to take away the ability for someone to think on their own about the slightest thing. All the thinking's been pre-done." And the house was wired. You never went to, literally, you didn't go to the bathroom by yourself. You weren't on a phone conversation by yourself. You were always being listened in on.
Control,
And
control.
it was all mind control.
In particular cases too, in terms of how people can react to future events that occur, why do some people handle it well and other people don't?
You know, a lot of people have a very easy time behaving well when things are going well. When things are coasting along, most people, are enjoying life. But what's fascinating to me about the sociology of disasters is that it really exposes the core. I know a lot of top executives that won't hire anybody or promote them into an executive rank until they've really been through a crisis to see how they handle,
That's
being
right.
under fire. And some people got it and some people don't. Some people you think are really put together solid, and then you put them through a crisis and they literally fall apart. And other people are weak, or appear weak or timid or overly humble. You put them through a crisis and they really stand up to it successfully. And I think it really comes down to core values, that me cornerstone, where the three things that I talk about are in alignment. What we know intellectually, what we believe in terms of our core values, and how we feel spiritually. What we believe, think, and feel have to align. When you got a person with those three things in alignment, they're going to handle a crisis very, very well.
Let's go now to the phone calls with Dr. Randall Bell, Rich Habits, Rich Life, the name of his book. Patrick in Oregon, west of the Rockies, you get us started here. Patrick, go ahead, sir.
Oh, yes, Mr. Norrie, it's great to visit with you tonight.
Thank
you,
sir.
It's a very interesting topic. I would like to ask your guest, has he ever dealt with estimating costs and damages associated with environmental disasters like the Gulf oil spill and that sort of thing? It would be very interesting to know.
Well, actually, Patrick, that's a great question because about 60% of my work is environmental. I worked on the BP oil spill. I worked on Hurricane Katrina where a refinery broke and oil was spewed over half of St. Bernard Parish. The biggest environmental case in world history was the case I was just talking about, the Bikini Atoll, where nuclear radioactive fallout came down on numerous inhabited islands. The biggest environmental case in U.S. history was Monsanto in Alabama. I worked on that case. The biggest case in California history is Avila Beach. So actually, that's where most of my work is.
And in these particular cases that you handle with those environmental disasters, how do you estimate cost? Is it for loss or is it for gain?
There's three elements of damage, and this is a methodology I put together years ago, and they become federal guidelines. You look at the costs, meaning the remediation costs, the assessment costs, those kind of costs. Cost, use, and risk is the formula. Use is the loss of use of the property while it's being remediated, because a lot of times you can't inhabit the property or you can't lease it out to tenants. And the last thing is risk. A lot of people call that by its nickname stigma. And it's basically that that fear or that elevated level of risk with buying a property that's been contaminated or it has mm-hmm. to be cleaned up.
Do you work with insurance companies?
All the time.
Because I would guess, you know, let's say, God forbid, a tractor trailer smashes on some guy and he loses his legs. What is that loss worth to that insurance company when the suit happens?
Yeah, my specialty is business and real estate, but there are actuaries that actually have tables. It's really kind of amazing where they can actually calculate the loss of a limb, you know, relative to the person's age and their profession and that kind of thing.
And that's how they make they make their offer based on that, don't they?
Yeah, they sure do.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Mayat in New York. Hello, Mayat. Welcome back.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Morning.
Yes, I want to make a comment, and then I'll ask my question.
All right.
And I'll listen over the air. Professor Bell, I would like you to take a second look, because what is troubling is the fact as to how it lines up in terms of black folks and white folks having the opinion on O.J., it really was, for those of us who studied it and followed the trial, it really was a professional hit. Somebody without the football injuries and arthritic knees, in spite of that ad through the airport, that would have been able to take down two people. And Investigation Discovery has a piece where someone said that his brother was connected to them and had evidence that he was a culprit. Additionally, Furman turned out the main police officer testifying, he manipulated the
blood. Yeah, he screwed up the whole case.
Yes, and he also, in an interview with a movie producer, told a scenario where he was in the hood and blood was spattered all over the walls. He beat people to death and there were no consequences. So take a second look. But my question is whether you had any professional involvement in either Katrina, the earthquake in Haiti, which had some odd characteristics in terms of how a usual earthquake happens, and also Fukushima. And if no professional involvement, whether just as a scholar and someone in your work, whether you looked at any aspects, and I'll listen to your answer over the air. Thank you.
Okay. Katrina.
Yeah, my great questions. First of all, on O.J., I certainly respect, and I have friends who believe that O.J. is innocent, and I respect them, and we get along just great, even though I've made my opinions clear. So I appreciate what you're saying. I think we can all agree that not only Furman screwed up, but also the judge, Ito.
We're friends with Bob Shapiro, who was one of O.J.'s attorneys, Randall.
Yeah.
We support his... late son's foundation every year.
And so I think there's different opinions, but we can all respect where everyone's coming from. So I take your comments, in that light.
Well, they sure created reasonable doubt, though, didn't they?
They sure did.
Oh, my God.
They sure did. On Katrina, yes, I was hired in Katrina. In fact, I've worked on cases involving Katrina for about 10 years. I just finished another case. I'll tell you, the media did not come close to describing the real destruction that went on at Katrina. The devastation was absolutely horrific, where it was town and city after town and town. And I drove all day. I ran out of gas, ran out of food, and decided I better stop and get some gas and eat. And then it dawned on me, there's no infrastructure. There are no restaurants.
There's nothing.
Yeah, it was absolutely unbelievable. The first time I went there, it was with a Marine who had just come back from Afghanistan. He said that Katrina was far worse than anything he'd seen in Afghanistan.
Wow.
I didn't work on Haiti, and I didn't work on Japan. I happened to be in Japan giving a speech when that happened. I can tell you that the mood there was very solemn, but I really can't comment too much on those two cases because I wasn't involved professionally.
We're taking your phone calls with Randall Bell, of course, and we've got him up until the top of the hour, so jump on board. First-time caller Greg in Florida is now with us. Hi, Greg. Thanks for calling.
Oh, it's my pleasure, George. That was pretty fast. I was expecting to wait a little longer.
There you go. First-time call. I wanted to get you in before the break.
Oh, all right. I'll make this quick as possible. I enjoy your show every night. Unfortunately, I suffer from insomnia. I'm only 36. I'm also appreciating and respect what your guest has to offer and does for others. My question for your guest would be this. Is someone like myself who suffers from bipolar, manic depressant, as they would say, social anxiety and panic disorder. You get in those moods where earlier in the show you were mentioning about when you lie, one of the two lies, and one of them being that there is no hope.
Mm-hmm.
It is so, so easy to fall within that abyss of how is there possibly any hope, because of what's going on in your head. It's as though you're screaming in your head. You look calm on the outside, you're crawling in your skin.
Yeah.
And yet when it rains, it pours, the old cliche. I mean, you know, so it's like, and then you're a family man like myself, so you're trying to hold it all together. And I just wanted to see what kind of insight was on that.
It is not easy. Randall, we got 40 seconds before the break. Go ahead.
Well, Greg, I think the fact that you are wise enough to even ask that question tells me that you are a person that is smart enough to have hope. And that's exactly what we have. I deal with people all day that have been really hammered. And it's just taking a step at a time, taking a close evaluation of our daily habits, rituals, and routines. Maybe making some adjustments to keep going forward in a positive way. We don't cure anything overnight. It's a long process for all of us. And I think by the fact that you've asked that question, I think you're on the right path.
We're going to come back in a moment and take some final phone calls with Dr. Randall Bell here. His book is Rich Habits, Rich Life. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch your dial. More exciting things just ahead. Now, you know, normally we have our special Coast Insiders chat on the second Tuesday of every month. That's me and you, second Tuesday of every month. Lex was on vacation last week. He gets back tomorrow. So we're going to do our chat tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Central Time. It's 8 p.m. Pacific Time. So make sure you're part of it if you're a Coast Insider. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you along with Dr. Randall Bell. This is our final segment here. We're talking about how to cope in a disaster. His book is Rich Habits, Rich Life. A couple more questions and we'll go back to calls, Randall. But how do people get your book? I assume Amazon's got it?
Amazon's got it, yeah. And it actually doesn't come out till January, but you can reorder it there.
Well, we're always ahead of the curve, aren't we?
You really are.
So how would you handle this in end of the world scenario where either an EMP attack, which is a pulse attack by a nuke in the atmosphere, or a solar flare from the sun shuts off the power system and everybody panics, making Katrina look like a small thing, or an asteroid is coming this way and government announces it and there's nothing we can do about it and they predict that, you know, it's going to be a planet killer. How do you handle that?
Well, I think the way you got to handle that is really look again more inward towards ourselves and our inner circle and see, you know, if we're ready to go. I mean, you know, whether we like to admit it or not, I see it on a daily basis. We're all, no one's getting out of this alive, this lifetime alive. And so if we have our lives in order, that's the ultimate protection against whatever can come our way.
All right, now we go to the final calls. We're going to Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Hey, Frank, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you.
I wanted to
ask your guest, when he represents people with the losses and especially devastating real estate,
mm-hmm.
how come in 23 states that real estate company doesn't have to tell you that there's been a mass murder inside the building when they're trying to sell it? And
yeah.
then here in California, Maryland, where I live, next to a Patuxent Naval Air Station, they had a hotel, a little small hotel. One of the guests used it as a meth lab. And when they finally found out what he was doing, they sold the hotel a year later and didn't tell anybody that one of the rooms was used as a meth lab. So, I mean, how do people that are trying to get compensated for that are victims of the real estate moguls?
All right. How do you handle something like that,
yeah,
Randall?
Frank, that's a very intelligent question. And the answer is half the states approximately are disclosure states, and half the states are what we call caveat emptor, buyer beware states. California and New York lead the charge in disclosure states. Very strict laws in California. You got to disclose everything. Same thing in New York. I just did a case in Pennsylvania, which is a caveat emptor state, and the case I worked on actually went to the Supreme Court or Superior Court over there, and they ruled that that the agents and brokers don't have to tell the owners. In this case I was working on, there was a homicide and a suicide in this lady's master bedroom, and it was a pathetic judgment made by pathetic justices who didn't stand up and look at what was obvious. If you're going to buy these properties, you should be informed what you're buying. So, Frank, to get back to your question, the best thing you can do to protect yourself is when you buy a property, they may not have the right to disclose or have the duty to disclose under the law, but they don't have the right to lie. And if you ask them in writing, are there any of these situations that have gone within the property, like you mentioned meth labs, murder, crime, suicide, you make a long list of disasters, and have them check boxes and sign their name where they represent that doesn't happen, you've got more of a leg to stand on because they don't have the right to lie to you.
Absolutely. Some states require you to disclose if the house is haunted, Randall.
Absolutely. New York and Georgia, there's even a case in Las Vegas where a house was reportedly haunted, and because of it, it sold for a premium. People bought the house, and they were disappointed they didn't see any ghosts, and they sold the house. So it works both ways.
All right, Alan is truck driving in Chicago. There you go, Mr. Windy City. You're up with us, Alan.
Hey, how you doing there, George?
Good. Thank you.
Is it? It's raining real hard down there in St. Louis?
Yeah, it sure is. It's been raining for the whole day.
Okay, it's only sprinkling up here, so we're good. I had a comment. November 18th is the anniversary of Jonestown. Jim Jones, Guyana.
That's right. That's right.
Now, he had mentioned, your guest had mentioned mind control. Jim Jones was on the intercom to these poor people all day long, and he played the tapes all night long, and he had forced beatings, forced druggings. He had these people working 16-hour days. I mean, he just wore them down to where they would just pretty much do anything the man said. You know, it's a definite tragedy. Like I said, it's going to be tomorrow. The 18th is the anniversary. I wonder what your guests thought about the mind control of Jim Jones.
And that mind control was absolutely unbelievable. What kind of power, Randall, does somebody possess to be able, as you were talking about Heaven's Gate, to convince so many people to do so many stupid things?
Well, that's a great question, Alan. The answer, I think, is and I talk about this very frankly in my book, because it's not all self-development, rah-rah stuff, cotton candy, you know, self-development stuff. I talk about real issues, and I talk about the fact that the reality in living life is that there are toxic people, and we've got to be aware of what the big three are. The big three are narcissists, sociopaths, and borderline personality disorder. Those are the three most common toxic types of people, and we need to be able to identify those traits. And once we identify them, we don't have to get into some professional diagnosis, but we sense when something's wrong and we get away. We don't engage. We don't get drawn in to the craziness that some people, you know, have. And it's that simple. Get away. There is no solution. These people will not recover. They won't seek help. They won't apologize. They're toxic. And we got to identify toxic people and head the exact opposite way. I've had to do it myself in my own life. We all have to do it.
You talk about the anatomy of a rich habit. Tell me about that.
Well, I'll tell you that, George, with a quick story. I volunteer at the homeless shelter here in Laguna Beach, and there's a guy named Danny. And Danny had gotten into some, he had made some mistakes, and he was in the homeless shelter. Ironically, he had once been Warren Buffett's neighbor. He had actually been a wealthy kid growing up with wealthy parents, but he blew it. He lost everything, and he was trying to rebuild his life. So going back to the caller Greg's question about, you know, how do I keep going forward? Here's how we did it. I said, Danny, you know, we got to get some new habits. And he was at first very arrogant and very upset that he was there in a homeless shelter. And finally, one day he came into class and he said, you know what, Dr. Bell, I'm going to start doing 50 push-ups a day. I'm going to go to the beach and meditate for 20 days. I'm going to go to the library and read one day, book a day. And he had this long list of habits. And I said, hang on, Danny, hang on. Pick one habit, the most important one to you. Pick one. And he says, okay, I'm going to do 50 push-ups a day. And I said, Danny, that's terrific. But we're not going to do 50 push-ups a day. We're going to do one push-up a day. And if you want to do 49 more or 100 more or 2 more or 0 more, that's okay. But your commitment is to do one push-up a day. The next week, Danny came back and said, Dr. Bell, I only did 6 push-ups a day. And I said, Danny, that's terrific. You've got yourself a new habit, and you beat your goal by 600%. I'm proud of you, Danny. And this is a guy who has not heard anybody say, I'm proud of you, in a long, long time. His face lit up. And from there, there was no formal obligation to any new habits. But within a month or two, he really was doing all the habits he originally committed for. One day I went into class, and Danny came up and he says, I'm sad. I'm going to miss you, Dr. Bell. I said, what's up? And he says, I've gotten a job. I've saved up my money. I'm sober. I'm getting back on my feet. I'm moving into an apartment on Wednesday. That's how we do it. We do it with a simple new habit, and it spreads out. We all agree, George, you'd agree with me, that one bad habit can spread out and ruin a life. The great secret that I've discovered by studying all these disasters all around the world is that the opposite is true. One new good habit, simple habit, spreads out and creates something really terrific.
Exactly. Even like negative programming, when a parent tells their little tiny baby child, don't spill that milk, what do they do? They end up spilling the milk.
You're absolutely right. Or the coach that says, you know, don't fumble.
And they fumble.
Yeah.
So how do you get around that, though?
The worst thing you can tell a kid is that they're special, because that really destroys kids, because they it's a whole psychology. What you say to a kid is, hey, you got an A, you must have worked really hard. It's a much better feedback to give to a kid. And the other thing is to say, go get us a touchdown. Don't say, don't fumble, don't spill the milk. Say, you know, point out the positive things and the work and the progress that people are making, and stop the I call it the trophy generation, where we tell kids that they're special simply because they walked across the room without falling over. I mean, we need to really applaud genuine success rather than just thinking everybody's special and entitled.
Like it's partly sunny instead of partly cloudy.
Bingo. Yeah.
Let's go to Anthony in Joplin, Missouri. Hey, Anthony, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Hey, obviously, I'm sure that you guys know about the Joplin tornado.
Oh, sure do. Sure do. I voiced a documentary for a company on that horrible situation.
Yeah. And I mean, I can make even a connection to the concert hall in Paris. I mean, we lost around 184 people between here and Duquesne over a 6-mile stretch. That's 180 people over 6 miles, and we're talking within one building over 100 people were killed, and that hits real close to home.
Sure does.
Just knowing the look of the bodies and stuff. My wife actually found this hit close to home for her when she found a picture on Facebook of a child that had actually been shot in the head, and he was missing the back of his skull. And Obama is wanting to drop a bunch of these refugees in Springfield, which is about 60 miles away. And some of my family thought that I'm crazy, but, you know, I've already told them, you know, I'm arming my family. You know, you guys do what you need to do. And I know a lot of my family has guns, and we're just preparing for what's about to come. That was our big thing in the tornado, is we weren't prepared. We weren't ready. And now a lot of the city has anxiety, and we're just not going to be caught off guard again.
How can you be prepared for something like that, Randall, a tornado that comes out of nowhere?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I lived in Santa Monica. I was going to UCLA as a graduate student when the LA riots happened, and I got this terrific idea that I'll go to the store and stock up, because I didn't have any guns, I didn't have any food, we didn't have anything in our little apartment, so I went down to the local grocery store, and I realized that the entire city had the exact same idea. Everything was cleared off the shelves, right down to the canned yam, stuff I'd never eaten before. I bought a few things I didn't even know what they were, and got in a long line and went back home scared to death, because we lived on 10th Street and the LA riots came all the way to 21st Street, 11 blocks away. That was my lifetime in West LA, which is not a bad area to live in. And from that day forward, I made a commitment that I would never be in that situation again. And I have food. I have protection. You know, one of the biggest things I see are looters and that kind of thing after Hurricane Katrina. You've got to be, you know, protect your property. And now, you know, I'm prepared. I can take care of my family for a full year, food, water, and shelter and protection. And that's what you got to do. And it took a situation like that to wake me up.
In crisis management, how do you handle situations where it just seems like it's impossible to pull out of?
Well, that's the second great lie. Nothing's impossible. You can pull out. A lot of it comes to, you know, thinking. And what I love about your show is you talk about these issues up front,
yep,
rather than burying our heads in the sand. And I really admire that and respect your listeners for paying attention to that. That's a big part of it. But, you know, losing hope is a second great lie. There's always a way out. I'm dealing with people that have really been nailed by some very serious disaster. And pick your variety. And the ones that give up, it's really sad, and I try and encourage them. But, you know, some people, they have their agency, and they make their decisions. But when you have that glimmer of hope, like that guy Danny I told you about, you can work with it, and you just take it a step at a time. Every time you go to the grocery store, you just buy an extra can of, you know, canned beans or something and stock it away. And before you know it, you've got yourself, you know, a real success in terms of preparation.
Let's go to David in Alabama, first time caller. David, thank you, sir. Go ahead.
One of the three tragedies I suffered in my life was in 1986, June 21st. A high speed chase on I-20 took half my family.
Oh my
God. A truck driver ran a weigh station in Georgia, ran all the way through to just about the Coldwater exit. And killed my mom, father, my 5-year-old little brother, and my mom's aunt and two cousins. Four of the victims died instantly. My brother died in flight to Birmingham.
Oh, my God. How old were you then, David?
21.
21 years old. My God.
And you have to live it one day. And, you know, you just have to go through one day and then the next day. And anytime you see a high-speed chase, it bothers you.
You can feel it, yeah.
You think about somebody else's family having to go through what you went through. The second tragedy I went through was a career-ending injury at work in 2003. Matter of fact, it was this past Saturday would have been 12 years.
What happened?
I had a truck run off on me. And when I tried to come off of it to get to the cab to stop it, it shattered my knee. So I was holding on to Keith from getting run over.
Geez, and there you go, Randall, how we were talking about those kinds of tragedies. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah, David, I'm sorry.
Well, and David, let me ask you, how have you coped with this? I mean, how have you bounced back?
You go through it, and then you start your own family, and, you know, you just have to live one day at a time. And, you know, some days it's worse. Any kind of tragedy that happens, it brings it all back. You know, it don't matter what kind of tragedy, major tragedy happens. You know, you think about your family.
You think about that.
Families you're going through.
I can't think of a worse thing to have to go through, but you're right. You do have to live every day like it is your last. Randall, the clock is ticking, and I want to thank you, one, for being on the program, and two, sadly, as we were talking about, I think we're going to all be going through these episodes in the near future. I just feel it.
I like we said, I hope you're wrong, but I think you're right. And all we can do is really pay attention to these principles, and because they work, they're proven to work, and implement them.
Absolutely. Randall, thanks so much. The name of his book, Rich Habits, Rich Life. We're going to take a jump into the future in a moment, talk a little bit about Edgar Cayce's prophecies, and, well, we shall be right back.